1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Alex Stone. Two opposite rulings by federal judges on the abortion pill. Here's ABC's Lindsay Davis.
A federal judge in Texas halting FDA approval of the abortion pill Mifepristone, which has been on the market for more than two decades. The judge says his decision will take effect in 7 days, giving the FDA time to appeal. The case could eventually reach all the way to the Supreme Court, which overturned Roe versus Wade last year.
Another federal judge tonight in Washington State issuing an injunction in a separate case brought by Democrats. The judge prohibiting the FDA from changing its approval of the abortion drug. More outrage over the Republican majority in the Tennessee State House kicking out two black Democratic lawmakers over their joining of a gun control demonstration. Meeting with them in Nashville, Vice President Harris.
We need leaders who have the courage to act.
President Biden invited the lawmakers to the White House. Leaky faucets are a safety problem on Boeing 787 Dreamliners, says the FAA. This is ABC News. Communities along the Gulf of Mexico are preparing for an approaching mass of seaweed that threatens to overrun beaches.
Seaweed is something that surfers like Aaron Hartwell of South Padre Island deal with every day.
It's in the water with us, and we just kind of paddle around it.
But now a massive raft of algae is making its way through the Caribbean and toward the Texas Gulf Coast, where it'll soon cover the beaches. South Padre Island plans to rake up the seaweed and bolster its sand dunes with it. It isn't harmful, but it's ugly and smells. Hartwell says.
It's really great for beach nourishment and just the general habitat.
It's already made landfall along the Florida coast. Jim Ryan, ABC News, Dallas.
The Centers for Disease Control saying flu activity is low this season with at least 26 million cases nationwide. CDC says a flu season reached its peak early, then began to decline. They warn influenza B could peak again later this season. 1 year from today, a total solar eclipse will sweep across 13 states in the U.S. from Texas to Maine. I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
This is so good.
Why are you eating so much popcorn?
Well, I'm making a difference for Wisconsin schools, and I was able to easily shop online.
I mean, it does look yummy.
OMG, you've got to try this cheddar jalapeno.
Mmm, it is good.
Oh, and I ordered a bunch of other gourmet flavors, chocolate delight, cookies and cream, and even dill pickle, delivered to my door. And I help Wisconsin schools in the process. Go to the Wisconsin Popcorn Shop at civicmedia.us/shop. That's civicmedia.us/shop. And order now. The shop closes April 10th.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Jail guards in Wisconsin can now choose better pensions. Governor Evers signed a bill into law yesterday that counts jail guards among Wisconsin's protective occupation participants. Police officers, firefighters, and prison guards are already in that group. Jail guards in Wisconsin can now retire earlier and get disability for injuries on the job. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is pushing for more money in the state budget for the State Office of School Safety. Call wants a little more than $2 million. The Office of School Safety was created 5 years ago after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Federal money for the office runs out in December. In sports, the Brewers are winners of five of their first six games. They host St. Louis tonight. The Bucks welcome Memphis. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
Over
on-
if you are 45 and older, don't let but stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then-
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, we've been talking about, over the last several months, the Veterans Administration and the fact that there are a lot of problems there. You know, staffing shortages, pay problems. There's a lot of things that need to be addressed. And, you know, the contract that was being negotiated, big part of this. Well, we now find out that the union representing those workers, and the workers have now come up with a tentative agreement. And this is, I hope, is a good thing. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what the agreement is and how it's going to maybe be very helpful for our heroes. I've asked Bill Wetmore to come talk with us. He is the AFGE National VA Council, third executive vice president. He's also on the bargaining team that negotiated this contract. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, walk me through simply, what'd we get? What'd you get?
Sure. So we were in negotiations for over a year. And before that, we were in litigation for about a year. And before that, we were in negotiations and for a couple of years. And it's all come down to this. We met with the VA secretary. Not all of us in the negotiating team, but some of us met with the VA secretary a couple Mondays ago. And basically, he put an offer that on the table that kind of surprised us. He said that if you just give me what I want in Article 23, which is merit promotion and discusses hiring and staff, that I'll give you the rest of your contract for another 3 years. So we've been ironing out that the wrinkles in that proposal and have eventually come up with something that was just signed, I guess, yesterday or the day before. I'm not sure who signed it first. But Article 23 refers to merit promotion, as I said. It talks about basically what we gave him was that forming panels. We used to have panels where representatives of the bargain unit, union representatives, would be sitting on panels to hire people and to staff the facility. We didn't make the final decision, but we made recommendations. And so it was management and labor was sitting on these panels. Now we've agreed to that if management wants us to sit on the panels, they will, but it's not compulsory anymore. It's entirely at management's discretion. If they want input from people who actually do the work, then they'll ask us to sit on the panels. If they think that they know enough about how the work gets done, they probably won't. Similarly, we had very strong language with regard to areas of consideration. That is that management first had to hire somebody to move somebody from one place in the facility to another place. And then secondly, that they would look at a larger geographical area, and finally the rest of the United States, three areas of consideration. We've basically given them everything they asked for in that. They get to have, again, full discretion in order to determine if they want to take somebody from the facility and move them into a new position, or if they want to go outside of the facility or maybe go to the whole United States.
Now, finally, some would argue that's a pretty substantial concession.
It's a very substantial concession, and I was personally very concerned about it, as a number of us were. I think everybody was very concerned about the concessions. There's another one, but let's talk about the fact that we're very concerned about the concessions. We think we gave a lot that the secretary wanted, in order to get that, he was willing to give us the rest of the contract rolling over. So there is some need to change some of the other articles to conform with the concessions that we made in the Article 23 merit promotion article. But otherwise, it's a complete rollover. And that's what we wanted from the beginning, was a rollover period without making any concessions.
So is this going to help fill the, and last time I spoke with someone, there was like 50,000 employees short at the VA. Is this going to help speed that process along? Is this going to help fill that gap? What's this going to do other than not have people who are current employees, shifting around? What's this going to do?
Well, hopefully it will speed up the process. Right now, the department, so there's two types of people in the department, Title V people, which are almost everybody in the federal government. And then the department has something called Title 38, which is basically the doctors, the nurses, the chiropractors, people like that who have licenses and are directly involved in treating patients. So those people, it takes the department anywhere from 120 to 150 days to hire those people. This will cut that down, hopefully, about 10 days or so. And hopefully that's significant. Similarly, for the Title V people, the regular kind of administrative staff, the people that that are first seen when you go to the hospital, the people who handle the benefit side of the department, the people that is give them compensation and pension benefits, and the people who are engaged in National Cemetery Administration, who end up taking care of veterans and their families in their last days. So for all those people, their hiring is taking like 90 or 100 days, and we hope that should be reducing it to about 80 days, hopefully. So
that sounds like an awful long time to get somebody hired.
It is an awful long time to get somebody hired. That's a problem in the federal government, period, frankly. And we can't solve that problem. That's an OPM problem.
Now, you guys, as a public sector union, a federal government union, you don't bargain over wages and benefits or any of that. This is strictly conditions, right?
Correct. Yes, there's a lot we do bargain on, but it's mostly procedures and appropriate arrangements. We don't bargain substantively on things like assignment of work or, as you say, the classification of a position, which directly bears on how much they get paid. And we don't bargain on like the insurance or health benefits that a federal employee gets. None of that stuff that's the normal main drivers of union activity in the private sector. But in the public sector, you're absolutely right.
Now, you guys do advocate for higher wages and better benefits because, as I'm told, a big part of the reason that there's such a shortage is because the pay is much lower and it's harder to attract people because the pay is lower because Congress won't appropriate. And I don't know if the administration's pushing hard enough, but they haven't really, as I understand, really pushed to make the federal jobs more competitive.
It's true. It's a problem that we have. I remember a staffer from a Republican committee one time that I was talking to, and he said, he flat told me that they weren't interested in making it competitive. They didn't want to be at the top. They were hoping to be somewhere in the middle kind of thing, but if they were lower, it wasn't such a problem. So, I think that it's everybody's concerned about balancing the budget, and the department is, right now is getting a lot of the money that it needs to hire people. And it's not simply that people aren't hiring. It's also that they're concerned that that budget won't be there in the future. And that kind of makes a lot of managers not hire people. There's a lot of problems with the hiring process in the federal government because there's so many merit system protection is so strong in the federal government. We don't want to get to a spoil system again. So people don't work at will. So they have to show that they're not performing, or that their conduct is so egregious that they need to be removed.
Right. So, because if you hear my right-wing friends say you can never fire a federal employee, which is not true, but it's like anything. Now, as Americans, we understand the concept of due process. The same should apply to the work environment as well.
Right. Absolutely. And we do have due process. That's in our contract. And that's not one of the things that's not being touched, of course, in the rollover. So there is a process. There is a statutory process. There is a contractual process. And it's designed to treat people fairly. However, if management does what they're supposed to do, and in fact determines that somebody's conduct is egregious enough to warrant removal, or that their performance is they're failing in some critical element in their job, then they remove them. And there's very little we can do about that, frankly.
Now, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bill Wetmore. Bill is the AFGE National VA Council third Executive Vice President. He's also on the bargaining committee that negotiated this contract. Let me ask you, in looking at different administrations, because, I'm thinking about, what you gave up and, the last administration was not friendly to you guys in any way, shape or form. Is there a way that what you got as a matter of compromise, would that be used against you, let's say, from that administration of the past?
Oh, I don't think that they need that in order to attack us again. If a person who had the similar philosophical and views and anti-union views that were so strongly present in the last administration came back, then we'd be back in very similar problems to what we were, where they actually took away our time to represent people, took away our office space, took away our equipment. Basically we were trying to defend employees and negotiate stuff on our own time. We'd had to take leave. We had to work nights and the weekends. I went through that. I've been representing employees since 92. And those years that we just went through in the last few years before President Biden came into office were the most difficult to get the job done. And the department did a number of illegal things, which we have prevailed in and shown. And so they've had to, they fired about 4,000 people improperly, illegally, as was determined in litigation. And so they were bargaining right now, trying to settle this thing and bring them back quickly. And so, again, this is, if that comes back, if that kind of attitude comes back in the White House, we're liable to be in the same situation that we were then.
Now, I've had a couple of my AFGE friends, say that this administration hasn't been as friendly as they thought it was going to be, haven't moved as quickly as people had hoped. What's been your experience?
I was a manager before I came to the department, so I have some idea of the difficulties of being a manager. I have some sympathy for it, but I think that I counseled a lot of people saying, it's going to happen. It's going to be okay. But it has been surprisingly difficult. Things have taken as long as they have, I mentioned before about this. We won that case 2 years ago, and the people still haven't been brought back to work. So there's a lot of things that kind of surprise me about the length of time that stuff has taken. We negotiated this contract for a year, and finally we come to this, like, easy settlement. Why didn't we come to this a year ago? Why did we spend all this time and money trying to negotiate something when we had this easy deal all along? So that kind of thing is troubling and concerning, that it seems like, if there's something to be done quickly that helps the employees and consequently helps the veterans, there's a number of studies that have been done by the department that show that when there's good labor management relations, that facility functions well. And when they're not good management relationships, that facility does not function as well.
Yeah, do we need studies for that, though, Bill? I mean, do we need studies to go that if you're treated well, you're going to work well? If you're treated like a bum, you're going to work? Do we need studies for that? I think, isn't that just common sense?
It is common sense, but of course we have a bunch of people who want to study those kind of things, and they do. Yeah. So, but I agree with you.
It is shocking. Shocking that if you treat people well, they're going to want to come to work, and they're going to do a great job, and they're going to be helpful to the people that are there. Because ultimately, and this is why I think what you do is so important, and what your members do is so important. The people that you deal with, the people that you're helping. There are folks we put up on a pedestal and called heroes, and we should treat them no different than that, what we gave them in the past, now. So to hear that this is a step in the right direction, I'm thrilled to hear it.
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled about it myself. I agree, and I agree with entirely. I mean, my mother, my father, my both uncles, my grandfather all served. And I don't think there's a more important segment in our population than veterans, frankly. I certainly try and do the best I can to make sure that they get the service that they deserve.
Well, good stuff. Congratulations on this. I hope it passes. I know it's tentative. I hope it does. But, you know, good on you and good on your members. And I appreciate you taking a little time to fill us in and share some thoughts.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it, Bill. If you want to check out more information, go to afge.org. That's the website. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to jump into a couple of emails. Gunther, watching on YouTube, emailed me today and said, Dear Rick, next time someone tells you that unions are not needed, tell them that the businesses have unions, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They no longer support business. He says small business anymore, he says, but just the large ones. Number two, business lobby groups. Number three, right-wing think tanks like Cato, Heritage, ALEC, and various business associations. He says that he learned all this stuff from Norman Goldman when he was had the Norman Goldman Show from September 8th of 2009 to 2019. Norman stated that these groups are like unions because the business people paid these groups membership dues to represent them at city, county, state, and federal levels. If these businesses can have unions to represent them, why can't workers have unions? And look, you know, this is the age-old question, and I've talked about this for years. You know, business groups are just they're organized capital, and the war between capital and labor has always been ongoing. As one gets too strong, they abuse the other. And we're in one of those moments right now, aren't we? Where the capital class, the Wall Street crowd, you know, our titans of industry are so powerful. The pendulum has swung so far to their side that they don't care about the laws. I mean, look at Howard Schultz. Been found guilty of doing things. Still, no, we didn't do anything wrong. because they have the power. They've got the money, the resources, and the laws aren't going to hold them accountable because they know the workers aren't organized. Now, my right-wing friends will say, well, you know, when they join the Chamber of Commerce, it's their choice. And they'll argue that, you know, labor unions should be the same. I'm of the mindset that if there's a union in a workplace and you benefit from that contract, you should have to pay for it. You should have to contribute. Now, you don't have to be a member, and that's how the law used to be, but you did have to pay for the contract to be bargained, to be negotiated, to be enforced, all of those things. It's, you know, you look at these so-called right-to-work states, it's really right to freeload. It's the right to get things that you're not paying for. Now, this is the weird thing, because I tried this a couple of years ago. Chamber of Commerce had a speaker come in that I wanted to hear. So I reached out to him, said, hey, I'd like to come to that event. And they told me this is the ticket price. And I said, do you charge your members that? And they're like, no. And I go, well, I don't want to pay either. They didn't let me come. And I said, look, you know, this is why this, but I should have the right, right? No. Only workers, they believe, should have that. Now, here's the thing. And I come back to this. Corporate America has banded together. They always do. Organized money always comes together. And their goal is to crush organized labor. This is why I've always been a firm believer in every worker in this country should have a contract. That's simple. Now, I've gotten pushback from people over this. Well, you know, we don't need no stinking unions. We don't need any of that stuff. They go, yeah, you do. You need protections. Every CEO in this country has a contract. We talked about this yesterday. So when, as I said, Home Depot fires, you know, Nardelli, they give him a $210 million going away present. Not because they liked him, not because they he was a buddy, because they had to. He had a contract. It's what's written down. It's what's negotiated. And I come back to every working people needs this often. Now, you think back to when labor unions were strong and they were advocating for better wages, hours, conditions in the workplace, but also better commons, better schools, better health care, better public services, better opportunities for families to, oh, I don't know, that old labor adage of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will, to have a life outside of your work environment, to have a life-work balance that, you know, family was part of it. Sadly, what we're seeing now is, you know, the moneyed interests have so crushed the ability of workers to get ahead that people are working 2-3 jobs and still struggling. You know, they made up a word for what corporate America does to workers, monsopony. It's where they've got so much power they can hold wages down. So much incredible power that they crush wages. Now, the Chamber of Commerce is one thing. He goes into these business lobby groups who go in and lobby to deregulate. You know, we don't need those safety standards. We don't need that clean air. We don't need that clean water. Again, on the other side, you've got labor groups going, we do want clean air. We do want clean water. We do need safer working conditions. Now, I've never advocated for, you know, labor unions to be in control of everything, but certainly not corporate interests. This is where collective bargaining is important. And just like we talked with Bill here a minute ago, they got to the table, they came up with an agreement. Some things maybe you don't like, got some things you did. That's the bargaining. The sad reality is you look at corporate America, they want it all. They want what Pennsylvania's workers' compensation law, you know, says about employer-employee relations. Master-servant. You'll do what we say, how we say, when we say, or we're going to fire you. Instead of going, no, we'd like to have some say in our workplace. Now, he also points out a lot of these right-wing think tanks that these business interests fund. And why do they do that? It's all about pushing legislation. It's all about changing political ideology. And this all goes back to 1971 and the Powell memo. And you could probably take it all the way back to Buckley back in the 50s. But it really was. These organizations sprung up for the sole purpose of lobbying for more for rich people and less for working people. The war between capital and labor is losing. And like Warren Buffett said, it's class warfare. and my class is winning, but we shouldn't be. Because after all, we, while they have all the money, we've still out-procreated them. There's more of us. If only we'd stop being divided by nonsense. If only we would come together and fight for what's really important. Maybe we'd stand a chance. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. And if you tried to make a telephone call that day, you might have been out of luck. During that time, telephone calls were connected by operators. 95% of the operators were women. The National Federation of Telephone Workers called for a strike against AT&T. The strike was one of the largest work actions by a majority female workforce in U.S. history. More than 300,000 women took off their headsets and walked off the job. Telephone service disruptions were widespread. According to the New York Times, the demands of the workers included a $12 per week raise. The union wanted to negotiate a nationwide wage scale. The workers also wanted a guaranteed pension minimum and more vacation time. The slogan for the strike was, "The voice with a smile is gone for a while." A while turned out to be a month. As the strike wore on, newspapers decried interruptions to the telephone service. The day after the strike began, the New York Times editorial wondered, quote, whether essential public services should be subject to interruption by work stoppages growing out of labor disputes. In the end, the union did not win a national wage scale, and the wages continued to be settled at the local level. The next year, the National Federation of Telephone Workers had reorganized to form the Communication Workers of America as part of the CIO. Although the strike was largely not successful, it showed the potential power of women in the workforce.
Operator, but could you help me place this call?
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
With new outrages erupting every day, I find some comfort in knowing that we the people have at least eliminated certain particularly ugly plutocratic abuses. Child labor, for example. Well, outlawed, yes. Stopped, no. Recent reports reveal that thousands of children ages 12 to 17 are toiling illegally at dangerous jobs in manufacturing, construction, food processing, etc. To be clear, there's nothing wrong with teenagers working. They might need to help their families, gain experience, or just earn a few bucks. Indeed, I worked part-time throughout my high school and college years, and while I did gripe some, overall, it was positive. So this is not about children working. It's about corporate child abuse, plain and simple. For example, last year, Packer Sanitation Services was caught, quote, employing oppressive child labor in meatpacking plants to clean saws, head splitters, and other butchering machines. In a typical incident, one 13-year-old was badly burned by the caustic cleaning chemicals they used during long night shifts, which ran from 11 p.m. to at least 5 a.m. Once caught, top executives of Packer Sanitation tried to sanitize their reputation by proclaiming that they have, quote, zero tolerance for any violation of child labor laws. Oh? Ask that 13-year-old. Yet, our worker protection laws are so weak that Packer's multiple violations resulted in a fine of $1.5 million. That's not even peanuts for this nationwide giant, which is owned by Blackstone, a Wall Street huckster whose executives pretend they know nothing about the children they endanger for profit. This is Jim Hightower saying, how about we make a few of the children and grandchildren of Blackstone profiteers work some midnight shifts cleaning meat-cutting machinery? I'm guessing they would stop the abuse overnight.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a new Reuters Ipsos poll finds that 40% of Republicans say that the criminal case against Donald Trump has made them more likely to vote for Donald in 2024. 12% said it has made them less likely to support him, and 38% said no impact. I am not shocked by that really at all. The hardcore base, I've always put between 35 and 40%. You're never going to move them. They're the fives. Never going to move. The other group. We'll see. Here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe this. Maybe even talk about the campaign video that Trump has put out. I've asked our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
So, what do you make of this? Any surprise in the aftermath of the indictments? Is that shocking to you?
No, it's not. I think there's a certain amount of I don't know. I would call it some sympathy vote too, I guess, for him. But from the Republicans, the effect of this would be for the undecided voters. The weakest part, and I was telling this to somebody today, the weakest part of the DA's case is when he says that this would have basically influenced the election, and that one I don't agree with, because now I look back on Trump's statement that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, was
yep,
it?
That's what he said.
Yeah, I'm starting to think. Maybe that wouldn't affect the polling either. So, but this affects people that have voted, for example, in series, Bush, then Obama, then Trump, then Biden. Any of the particular swing voters, as they call them. They always refer to Wisconsin for some reason, this group. But anyway, the swing voters, I think, yes, it does have an impact.
Yeah, I don't see anything in this that gets Trump new voters. The fact that 12% said that they'd make them less likely to support him. I think it still hurts him long term.
Well, yes,
I see, do see him winning the primary. But I see him, if he is the nominee, getting crushed in the general.
Yeah, I don't. I'm still going to hold to what I said on your show last February. Not this past February, but a year ago, which is that he will not be in the convention. I don't think before all this happened, I didn't think that would happen. I'm still going to hold to it. There'll be a particular reason or something out of it, but I will go back to my gut tells me his ego cannot take, even if he said, "I was cheated," it can't take a loss. Now, President Biden's numbers are not good. I mean, they came up a little. There's a long way off.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Bob, and this is where I'm tired of these numbers. How many presidents have great numbers in the midterms? I keep seeing people, they're saying Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election. And maybe that's true. I would like to see someone who can deliver a better sentence. But I'll tell you, the policies he's moving, I'm thrilled with. But if you get me to the general election and Biden's the nominee, no matter if I don't want him to be the nominee, I'm going to vote for him over a DeSantis, over a Nikki Haley, over a Donald Trump any day of the week.
Well, yeah, especially over Trump, in particular, and probably DeSantis too. I'm not talking about you, but voters. But I'm just saying that his numbers at this particular time are lower. And yes, you're right. A lot of presidents in the midterm, are. It would depend on, how he's able to proceed and what, happens. I mean, there's a little bit of time left. The thing I've told people, this notion when they take it a step farther, it's one thing for Democrats that are polled to say, I like him, but maybe he ought to not run, and you're right, in the end they'll support him. But, it's another thing to have this notion that some people have, that I know, they're going to replace him. Somehow magically, he's going to step out and they're going to replace him with somebody or run somebody. You can't do that.
So then
you can't.
my mind immediately goes when that comes up, and I've heard this from a number of people, my thought then goes to, so what's your fear then? Is the fear then Kamala Harris?
Well, if you want my honest candor,
no,
opinion,
lie to me, Bob.
Oh, I won't on this one. I would, you know, if I was a consultant, I'd be like, you know, anybody but Harris. I'm sorry, but I'm just, I don't have anything personal against her, but I've never seen anybody implode quite as fast, and I just don't think she is a viable option, period. If the president would decide somehow, for some reason, that, you know, he's not going to run, and I saw an article the other day, and in fact, in my news notes that I send out, I even put a comment in there that, you know, whoever is putting this out sure feeds a headline, but they, in a story, it was, I can't remember, major news network, but in a story they said, well, you know, the president hasn't announced yet, and this does nothing but favor Kamala Harris. If he announces late, you know, it would push all the Democrats out. I don't think so.
No. Not at all. But I do expect him to delay this, because he doesn't have to announce anytime soon. He can let this play out if he does plan on running, and just let the Republicans eat themselves. I'm okay with that. So I got to get your thoughts on this campaign video, though. Trump released this, you know, this dramatic campaign video with the footage of, you know, of his arrest, and again, you know, this is what we knew was going to happen. You knew he was going to lean into it and make himself a martyr out of this, and, oh, by the way, send money.
Right. You know, the ad shows scenes from around Manhattan, and then, of course, it shows Trump, you know, walking into the arraignment. They've got voiceovers from people. I don't know. I'm not sure who they are. Criticizing, you know, the prosecutor, and of course Trump saying that, you know, he's innocent. And
innocent. This is the part that gets me. He's guilty of falsifying records. Now, you could argue, because everybody, especially, you know, people I know on the right are going, yeah, he did all of this stuff, but it shouldn't be a felony. This is where a lot of the people I know, a lot of conservatives I know, are going, no, it shouldn't be a felony. They're inflating these charges. They're 136 years in jail for, you know, writing something wrong on a piece of paper. That's, we don't give murderers that kind of stuff. That's the argument that I'm getting from people. Not that he didn't break the law, but that they've overinflated the charges.
Right, and that the charges are, quote, weak, and, of course, the Edwards case is referred to all the time, and the fact that the Justice Department did not pursue Donald Trump, which is, you know, it puts a lot of thought in your mind, why didn't Justice Department, are they afraid, or they didn't think there was enough, you know, which is it, you know, why they didn't do it. But I think that if another case happens, for example, Georgia, because I don't believe anything will happen on classified documents, and I don't believe anything will happen from the feds on January the 6th, but if the Georgia case happens, then that's when I'll go back to reaffirming my point, which I'm still holding to, that he won't be in the convention as the nominee. I mean, you can, you know, even Teflon Don can only stand so much to where the numbers, you know, will not be good at all for the general election.
Yeah, could that be the argument, though? I got to back out to deal with all this legal stuff. Could that be the argument?
What's that?
You know, Trump's just saying, look, I can't run for president and defend myself from this onslaught of attacks from all of these people.
Yeah, I mean, what he won't ever do is admit he's not going to run because he can't take psychologically,
good point,
narcissistically, or his ego can't take a second loss, whether it's, quote, stolen, you know, or not, because what he'd say. But I do believe that there'll be something there, you know, well, for the good of the party, the, you know, the deep state wants, you know, to go after me. I don't know. There'll be something utilized to get out of it, especially, again, if Georgia crops up, because after a while, you start to look at this, and can we really stand an entire election about his court battle?
Oh.
I mean, gasoline's going up again. The Saudis have screwed us. We still have, rising costs and issues that people are going to argue about how to solve them. We all agree we have them. It's how to solve them. Now, do we want to do that and talk about, the future of the planet, et cetera, or do we want to talk and hear about his court case all campaign long, including the media, which, if he is running, they will do that.
Yeah.
They won't stop.
No, you're know right, because he's the attraction. The clown, yeah. The clown
national
is center stage.
Media.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst. I've got to get your thoughts on what happened in Nashville. When we talked on Monday, you said didn't think it was going to happen. I said, yeah, I think it's going to. We were both kind of right and kind of wrong. Two-thirds got, two black guys got thrown out. The white woman made it by a single vote. She snuck under the wire. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, she didn't get on the bullhorn.
Is that what it is? That's
yes. She didn't. She went down front, but she didn't speak out. The reason I didn't think they would do it, I thought they would come back legitimately with, we don't care what the issue is. I'm just putting myself up, if I was there in leadership. We don't care what the issue is. We know it's important. And issues we care about, again, we don't care what the importance of the issue is. We cannot have a breakdown of the system or all issues are irrelevant. I mean, you can start out like that and say, if this happens again, we're going to consider expulsion. That's what I thought would happen. Now, the irony of all this is very clear. First of all, in the state of Tennessee, Ohio doesn't have these provisions. In the state of Tennessee, if you're expelled, an expulsion from the legislature, the county commission, we call them in Ohio, but the county committee in Tennessee appoints for the special election. So guess who's going to get appointed?
Both of them.
Number two, if they don't get appointed, guess who's going to run and win the primary, right? And then the general election for it. Now the voters are going to have to pay for a special election. So they're going to be back. And again, I understand, you can't have in Congress people coming down to the well of the House screaming with a bullhorn, for example, and doing this, and then the next group wants to do it, and then Marjorie Taylor Three Names is down there every morning doing it. So I understand, but I really, Rick, thought that they would come to their senses and just say, hey, this is what you violated, and, we're giving you a warning.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they took it a step farther, and you're right, with one vote to spare, the white female was kept. I do think part of it probably, it's not because of the lack of her on a bullhorn. I think she probably had some friends. I think some of the Republicans, might have also voted. She's been in longer, too. So, I mean, that's all wrapped together part of it, and it was all nonsense to do it in the first place.
Yeah, but from looking from the outside, when the two black guys get expelled and the white woman gets away, the messaging, Bob, just from the outside, with all of that other stuff, it looks really bad.
Even if I'm correct, which I think she's been there a while, she's probably had some friends, even if I'm correct, it doesn't matter what I just said, because the messaging is, you can't undo the messaging. Yes, you can't. They all three were down there. She might not have grabbed the bullhorn. Maybe they wouldn't let her talk. I don't know, but she should have. Technically, if you're going to get two of them, you should get the third.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's it's one of those things where the meme, show me you're a racist without telling me. Well, they did that. I mean, that's what it looks like.
This was the death penalty for first offense.
Yeah.
I understand the system. I understand you just can't go scream. I get all that. But it was the death penalty for the first offense. That's why I really didn't think at the end of the day they would go through with it. But they did.
But they did. Mm-hmm. And I guess the death penalty. See, there's a whole lot of me. There's a lot there. We're going to move on. We're going to move on right now.
Okay.
I want to get your thoughts on Clarence Thomas. Thomas came out with his defense today on the taking luxury vacations and all this stuff. And my take on this is I just have all the wrong friends. I need some better friends because according to him, he doesn't have to, to report or disclose any of the trips or any of the things that he gets because they're from friends, billionaire friends who just want to be good to them. I've never had a friend take me on a luxury vacation and say, don't worry about it. I'll pick it up. Evidently Clarence does.
Well, there's a couple of things here. Post-Watergate has a disclosure. Judges do have a leeway on food and on dinners. And in Congress, there is some leeway on previous friends and dinners. Of course, it depends who you are, if you can get away with it or not. But anyway, they have it. Now, if you're asking me...
I'm asking you, because you got in trouble for this.
In trouble? Here's the bottom line. He took 20 years worth of trips on the plane. Forget the food. Put the food aside for a second. Let's not even talk about the rooms, right? One trip alone was $500,000 potentially. But 20 years worth of air flights, which are clearly to be disclosed, right? 20 years worth of it. I disclosed my trip. It wasn't the right amount, but I disclosed it. So if you're asking me, and I disclose it now for, 18 months, which is what my plea deal was, and I got 30. So if you're asking me about a financial disclosure, yeah, he should have disclosed it. Will he go to jail? No. But this is a really bad, bad thing because this is the highest court. And the judges, frankly, are supposed to be above reproach, above a member of Congress, in the eyes of people. It's the Supreme Court of the nation. Now, they haven't even got in yet to this billionaire and who has, he has friends who, did he do a wink and nod to the justice? Did the justice know his friends were involved with, this and that and realty and decisions, that eventually would affect them? But even with all of that aside, if we say, oh, no, they never talked business, he didn't disclose. You have to disclose.
Yeah.
And
the other part that gets me is, as I'm reading his excuse, is because everyone around him told him he didn't have to. How deep does this go with Alito? Who paid off Kavanaugh's debts? There's a lot of questions here that now should be investigated and looked into.
Right. There's not going to be an impeachment. There's only been one in the nation's history and never, confirmed. There's not going to be impeachment with the Republican House. But he's got to answer. I'll throw this out here. I can answer it. Who steps up to say, you need to answer this? You need to explain why you didn't report it. I'll tell you who I think.
It's got to be John Roberts.
Roberts and also the same people that made me talk about my trip to the Justice Department. I told them I thought it was okay what we filed. They didn't think so, So they pursued it further. Somebody's got to make him answer. And Roberts, yes, for the internal, but also this is under the jurisdiction because the financial disclosure law post Watergate was for judges, and he is a federal judge. He is federal, appointed by the president. He's not a state judge. He's federal. The highest.
But none of that's going to happen.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I asked the question. I knew the answer, but I just don't think... I don't know if the Justice Department has the guts. But to me, somebody should sit down with him from Justice. Why not? And say, you didn't fill out the forms. We'd like to know why. Will he then turn around and say, you can't question me, I'm Supreme Court Justice? Is that a different judge in following the law than a federal district court judge or, a federal judge in a state? I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions here, especially when you start getting into how much money Ginny gets.
Somebody needs to ask him this. And Roberts, it needs to start with Roberts, but I think that you know, following who has jurisdiction over the legal authority of financial disclosures. It's very clear. It's the Justice Department.
There you go. That's what we're going to start calling for. There needs to be a Justice Department investigation.
Some people are talking impeachment. Good luck.
Yeah,
we know where that's going to go.
It's going nowhere.
Nowhere. Right.
Lock him up. All right. I think I'm there. Bob, I appreciate the time.
Okay.
Always great talking with you.
Thank you.
Yep. That's where we need to go. Bob knows. Bob's the guy. He knows. He's been there. Just start, get him under oath and start asking questions. Yeah. It's never going to happen, but it'd be interesting. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Their slogan was Justice for Janitors. Their chant was Si se puede, yes we can. Their image was a red and black poster of a mop raised high in a clenched fist. 3,000 members of SEIU Local 1877 marched in the streets of downtown Los Angeles. Many of the marchers were Latina women. Some had their children with them. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. The massive protest marked the third day of their strike for a better life. The janitors were some of the poorest paid workers in Los Angeles. Their average wage was over $6.70 an hour. This was well below the janitorial wage of most other major cities in the U.S. Picketing workers targeted downtown office buildings. 18 contractors oversaw the janitorial services in these buildings. The workers demanded $1 an hour wage increase for 3 years. The contractors refused to negotiate. Several prominent politicians and religious leaders supported the strike. Finally, after 3 weeks, the strike was settled. The union won a 25% wage increase over 3 years. Although it was a sizable victory, it fell short of the hoped goal for $3 an hour. Jose Chayas, a shop steward and member of the negotiating committee, explained, "Even as united as we were, every nickel was difficult." On the janitors' campaign, which includes nearly a quarter of a million workers. In the next 2 years, 130,000 janitors in 33 cities across the nation will negotiate their contracts. Very likely, this will include janitors in a city near you. Will you support their fight for justice? Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. So I want to finish up with my favorite story of the day. Understand, I said at the when the indictment came down for Trump that this was going to be the grifters' gold mine. This was the fundraisers' wet dream. This was going to be, oh my gosh, tingly all over. And the email box hath been full of, they're indicting our hero. Send us money. You know, they're going after our guy. Send us money. Send us money. Send us money. And the attacks on the judge and the judge's family and the judge's, wife and daughter, all that stuff have been included in these emails. It's the cabal is after them. Maybe you've seen them too. Well, I got a couple that said the judge is compromised. Need to do away with the judge because evidently the judge is a campaign donor to Joe Biden. The judge, Judge Juan Merchant, he gave money to Joe Biden. So I had to go look at this up and go, well, maybe he did. And there's nothing wrong if he did. It's not illegal. But I got to tell you, I had to call somebody to calm me down from laughing because I got these emails saying, this guy's a big donor. This guy's a donor to the Biden campaign. And you need to give us more money to counteract this donation. The judge donated $15. $15. That's it. And they're losing hair on fire. I'm thinking maybe he bought a T-shirt. I don't know how you donate $15 to a presidential campaign if you're a judge. Maybe, hold on. Maybe he doesn't have any billionaire friends. That's probably what it is. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you grab our podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. You got questions, comments, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you have a wonderful weekend and great holiday. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News
app.
About